You are tuned to 106.1 FM WSCA LP Portsmouth. We are Portsmouth Community Radio.
Seaport town, step my foot in a steamboat, sail the ocean around. Sailing around the ocean, sailing around the sea, thank the handsome Molly wherever she may be. Sunday she passed me on by. I knew her mind was changing to the rolling of her eye. How do you remember Molly when you gave me your right hand? Say if you ever married I'd be the man.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Local Folk. I'm your host, Steve Carrigan, and that track that I just played is an indicator of the guest that I have on tonight. As you know, I bring on guests to my show that, in one way or another, are connected to the local music community or the music community in general, and this is a first for me tonight, and I'm really looking forward to it. But you got to do what you got to do. So here's something that's going on in the community. Strawberry Bank Museum in Portsmouth is hosting a monthly winter lunch and learn series. They've done a lot for local history, and they've actually helped to make this place of Portsmouth, New Hampshire, spectacular. So in sort of a subdued New England-y way.
Yeah, and right now they're providing parking to the residents of the South End, so that's even more of a contribution.
Better than lunch.
Especially when you're snowbound.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. You know, if you had to lunch and learn, bring what you want, and you get out of it something really special. I always love to learn a little bit more. All right, by the way, I didn't do the weather. All right, right now we have light drizzle. Fog, mist, 33 degrees Fahrenheit. It was a dark and stormy night. There's a chance of rain. There's a chance, possibly mixing with snow after midnight, then gradually ending. Areas of dense fog, otherwise mostly cloudy, with a low around 33. West wind 6 to 8 miles per hour. Chance of precipitation is 30%. New precipitation amounts less than a tenth of an inch possible. It sounds pretty dire out there. That's tonight. Well, Tuesday, you know, what did they say? The sun will come out tomorrow? Well, Tuesday, mostly sunny with a high near 42. West wind 9 to 17 miles per hour. Tuesday night, partly cloudy with a low around 26. West wind 7 to 13 miles per hour. That is it for the weather. That is all of the things other than Local Folk that I need to do. Now it's time to get to Local Folk. I have with me for the very first time an author, someone who has written a book. I'm holding it right in my hand. It feels heavy and substantial. It's a hardcover book. It has two people playing instruments on the front of it. It's called Lonesome Melodies, The Lives and Music of the Stanley Brothers. And my guest tonight is David W. Johnson. David, thank you for being on Local Folk. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Steve. I am very pleased to be on Local Folk.
Yeah, I am pleased, too. First time as an author. See, what I always try to do on Local Folk is to Well, my aim is to get people involved in music in one way or another. And you are the first person that I've had on that's written a book about music. Now, let me ask you something about you. Did you ever play an instrument?
Yes, I played guitar for what I call a mere 35 years or so, and gave it up in order to make room to write the book. But I used to be an open micer around the seacoast.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know that.
Used to press room and the loaf and ladle back in the day.
The loaf and loaf and ladle?
The loaf and ladle, yes, in Exeter, New Hampshire.
Hey, they make a heck of a bowl of soup.
They do.
And they're not paying me for that. I'll tell you what, you know, that's a great idea, soup and sandwich and then music.
It is. Strawberry Bank might be interested in that as a program.
They might, except, well, at Strawberry Bank, you bring your own soup and sandwich.
That's the catch.
My friend Kevin Scanlon used to play down at the Loaf and Ladle sometimes, and he used to play Handsome Molly.
Oh, okay.
Which is the song that we started off with. You've written a song, I think people might have done biographies about Ralph Stanley. Am I wrong about that?
No, you're right about that.
Okay.
There are a couple of biographies about Ralph and also an autobiography.
Okay, but this is the Stanley brothers.
Yeah, I thought it would be fun in the sense of spending 11 years with two people you don't know is fun. It was fun. But I thought it would be interesting to write about the period when Carter and Ralph played together, which was from 1946 to 1966.
Okay, so let's get clear here. First of all, let's talk about who the Stanley brothers are.
Carter and Ralph Stanley. Carter born 1925 in Spraddle Creek, Virginia. I think it's actually Big Spraddle Creek, Virginia.
Big Spraddle.
Yep. Don't mix it up with Small Spraddle Creek. Never. And Ralph born approximately in the same place 2 years later, actually 18 months later, and that they are Carter and Ralph Stanley, professionally the Stanley brothers.
And they professionally do what?
They professionally play old-time country music and bluegrass.
Okay, so they're two bluegrass musicians, two of them, brothers.
Two brothers, right, who formed a band in 1946 and played together until 1966.
46 to 66?
Yes.
That's 20 years.
Well,
they were alive, and they kept on going. I mean, what happened after 66? Why?
Well, Ralph Carter died December 1st, 1966, which was a tragedy. He was 41 years old. It was a death that people could see coming. But
what was it?
From complications related to alcoholism.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and Ralph has carried on for another 40-something years since that time. So Ralph Stanley is one of the true musical landmarks who ought to be on musical Mount Rushmore.
Does he have like an iron liver, or would he just didn't live as hard?
I think Ralph was a temperate kind of guy and didn't live as hard. As he put it one time, he was a wild one when he was young, but he met a woman whom he married later and settled down, and now is kind of the icon of country and bluegrass.
No kidding. Huh. Sounds a little bit like me, except I'm not an icon.
Well, you're more the icon of, I think, Celtic and the press room. But there's room for more than one icon.
Well, the good news is that I used to be a little wild when I was younger, and now I'm not so much anymore. So thank goodness I made it over the hump. I'm more in the Ralph category, I hope, although I could croak tomorrow. You never know how it goes, do you?
We shouldn't really go down that morbid trail, because some of the music will probably go down there for us. But but if you're planning on something dramatic, we should talk about me doing my second book on you before it's too late.
Nothing dramatic, believe me.
Thank God.
Nothing dramatic. That'd be my curse in life, quite frankly, is to have some sort of big dramatic thing. My God, with a million goodbyes and this and that and the other thing. The idea would be quick, but old.
Well, you never get more attendance than at the farewell show.
Yeah, no kidding. That's what I've heard. I've seen it before, you know. Anyways, this is totally off topic.
Well, we're just getting in the mood for old time mountain music here.
Well, tell me about old time mountain music. Anyways, I mean, they talk about this stuff all the time.
Well, let's see. ancestry, it comes sort of from the Scotch-Irish tradition, basically meaning Northern Ireland. Settlers coming to the United States, settling down in the, going down the Great Valley of Virginia and settling in Virginia, and then actually going through the Cumberland Gap down into Kentucky and bringing their ballad tradition with them. And so the Stanley brothers are two offspring of that tradition, as in their family had come to Virginia in about the 18th century and had farmed the rocky soil there. And then Ralph and Carter took a look around and said, we don't want to go into coal mining or sawmills or anything like that. We want to make music and you know, make a career for ourselves.
Well, that's really what they said was, hey, we want to become professional musicians?
Absolutely. From an early age, as in when they were kids, they would listen to the Grand Ole Opry and take kindling and act as if they were playing guitar and banjo. So they wanted to play music.
They wanted to play music.
Absolutely.
Okay. Did they saw it as a way out?
Yes, they did. And that Ralph's pretty explicit about that in his autobiography. And since he was explicit about that, I took his quote and put it in my book.
Okay, yeah. I mean, he was, well, pretty clear. And he did well for himself.
Ralph is an amazing, amazing person. He was born again, a born-again Christian in 1999. I mention that because he attributes his success that came late in life, as in the use of the brothers' music in the soundtrack of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, the film, 2000. That has made Ralph a wealthy man, but he had to pursue his music for 55 years before he got there.
So, that's a long time.
He's still out there. He's still touring. Very limited. I understand that his health is not the best. His 86th birthday will be February 26th, so we can wish him a happy 86th birthday.
86?
Yeah. Still touring.
That's pretty darn good.
On
what
his
do you
blue
think
bus.
Of the idea that somebody works for 55 years, hard, works hard for 55 years playing their music, and then it becomes popular from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, and then attributes it to having been born again, what, 50 years ago?
Born again in 1999. He was...
Oh, really?
As so, in that he was rebaptized. One anecdote is just Ralph had a dream in 1999 in which two ministers appeared, his current-day minister and the minister who had presided over Carter Stanley's funeral in 1966. And in his dream, these two ministers told Ralph, "Ralph, it's about time you were born again." So at about 5 or 6 in the morning, he called up the living minister and said, "I need to be born again." And the minister said, "Fine, Ralph, we'll set that up." And Ralph said, "I'm going to be born again today." And he went down to the Clinch River in Virginia and was immersed.
The Clinch River?
Yeah.
It couldn't be more bluegrass than that, could
no,
it?
No, well, it's Ralph Stanley and the Clinch Mountain Boys, and it was Carter and Ralph and the Clinch Mountain Boys. Yeah, so they are products of the place where they were born, and they're very much of the Clinch Valley and the Clinch Mountain.
So how long after that before the Oh Brother, Where Art Thou became popular?
Well, 1999 was the born again event, and 2000 was the date the movie was released, and the music was made sometime around that time.
No kidding.
Now I'm quoting Ralph's view here, but still Ralph is a man of great faith, and he's very emphatic on that subject. He feels that being born again is what caused his sudden prosperity after 55 years of working hard.
Oh, well.
So if you and I work hard for 55 years and are born again, we might do well.
Well, I mean, let's face it, you know, if you're like, I've been working on this book for a long time, and finally, after being born again, I was invited on the local folk radio show.
Exactly, and I appreciate that. That's one-fifth of Ralph Stanley's journey, but 11 years felt like a long time working on the book. I started about 2001.
So this program is not even really about Ralph Stanley. It's actually about you. 11 years writing books. I know that people write books for longer and shorter and whatever else, but I mean, tell me about, what were you doing before the 11 years happened, because you're more than 11 years old. You're at least 20.
I thought I hid that with my Grecian formula.
No.
Okay. I'll admit to even 30. Anyway, 66 for the record.
66. So what were you doing before that? You were playing music at open mics? Were you playing bluegrass?
No, I was playing, you know, singer-songwriter kind of stuff, a little bit of Dylan. I leaned in a country direction, but I didn't have any particular affinity to bluegrass.
Where are you
point.
From?
Actually, I'm from Hartford, Connecticut.
You're from Hartford, Connecticut,
yeah.
The place of where all the insurance comes from.
Exactly. Not exactly bluegrass country.
Not really. That's, no. Every insurance company in America is in Hartford, Connecticut. Why is that? They're all over the place. They're crazy.
I guess they're very good at estimating life expectancies down in Hartford. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Not bad. So here you are in life insurance, and they're all short in time. You're like, we should probably talk about your future. And Connecticut, you know, right next to Rhode Island.
Very straight-laced state, Connecticut. But I was only there 3 months, so I moved.
But you didn't move to Clinch Valley.
No, I didn't. How that came about was I went on a little academic gypsy odyssey. Where I was
academic gypsy odyssey.
I found out that you could get paid approximately $40,000 to $45,000 a year if you were willing to take 1 or 2 year positions as like a visiting assistant professor or a sabbatical replacement or something like that at various colleges and universities. And since I didn't have a doctorate, that struck me as the way to go. And one of those was a 2 year appointment at Emory and Henry College in Emory, Virginia, which is about an hour away from Clinch Mountain.
Okay. See, now it's all starting to happen. So you went to school and you had a bachelor's degree, but you didn't have a master's degree?
I got the master's at BU in communication, but I didn't have a PhD.
Oh, you didn't have a PhD at the time. So you had a master's degree, and then you're like, cha-ching, I can make a few bucks here if I do this. And then you wound up right next to Clinch Mountain. I mean, maybe you didn't have big dollar signs in your eyes.
No. Matter of fact, I had about $40,000 signs in my eyes in the sense of that's what they were willing to pay me down at Emory and Henry. Might have been 39. Anyway, I had a longstanding interest in music that had kind of developed as I migrated to Pennsylvania, where I was a folk show host at WPSU. And it was much more bluegrass in Pennsylvania, and I began to pick up a little bit on bluegrass.
Okay, so I've skipped a whole giant portion here. You know, you grew up in Connecticut, but you were a talk show host in Pennsylvania?
Folk show host.
A folk show host.
Yeah. Rotate, and it was a great title for a folk show. It was called The Folk Show.
Wow, that's good. It's almost as good as local folk.
Local folk is like poetic compared to the folk show, seriously.
So, wait, how'd you get that? Now I need to go all the way back. I was born in Connecticut, but then you had an interest in music. You learned guitar, you know, and then how did you wind up with what got you involved in even radio or music or anything? What am I missing here?
I don't know. I guess
did your parents play music?
No, my dad played the piano. The thread. We'll go for a narrative thread.
Yes.
Is that I was a New England guy pretty much all my life, and then in search of employment began to live outside of New England and was exposed to, just strictly in terms of music, increasingly traditional kinds of music. And also that was the direction I was headed in personally in terms of my interests. So whereas in Pennsylvania I had learned a little about bluegrass from people who either played it or it appeared on the radio, I lived in Virginia for a little bit before I was down in southwestern Virginia, and I went to bluegrass pretty much every weekend.
Went to bluegrass, what do you mean by that?
There was a club in Alexandria, Virginia, a restaurant actually, that had bluegrass every Friday and Saturday night, and I went over there and listened and began to hear, you know, the repertoire as played by a lot of very good Washington, D.C. bluegrass musicians.
What was the first bluegrass that you were at? How old were you when you were at this session, first of all?
The Virginia session?
Yeah, the Virginia session.
Oh, well, that's, you know, I was, I don't know, in my 50s, I guess, you know.
Oh, so, okay.
Yeah. The original interest, just as a kid growing up in New England, let's see, I used to watch things like Louisiana Hayride when it would be coming in on television. For whatever reason, I was kind of drawn to country music.
Well, that's what I'm wondering is what led to the draw towards the country music. Was it just you said, hey, this sounds good? I mean, was it as simple as that?
Yeah, I don't know. I remember hearing Leroy Van Dyke sing Miller's Cave and the Everly Brothers sing I Wonder If I Care As Much, which is a flip side of some song, but it's very country. And it was that brother sound, too, that kind of got to me.
Brothers sound.
Yeah, the sibling harmony.
Sibling harmony.
Yeah.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I do. And that's a big part of why I think I was interested in the story of the Stanley Brothers. I have a brother who's a very good musician, and we sort of grew up together liking the music, and then another one of my brothers and a sister also liked the music, and we never really played together, so I think I was kind of intrigued by these guys who, you know, pretty much lived in each other's hip pockets.
So, well, yeah. I mean, well, by the time you started researching this story, Carter was gone.
Long gone. Yeah, I started researching in 2001 after seeing Ralph on stage in Nashville in 2000.
You know what I'm going to have to do? I think I'm going to play a song.
That'd be great.
By these guys, and then I'm going to have to do a public service announcement, or I could do one or the other. So why don't we just, I'd like to play a little something here that I think I saw. Hold on just one moment.
Okay.
What I'm wondering is, by the time you met Ralph Stanley, you already knew quite a bit about bluegrass music, correct?
I knew something about bluegrass music. I'm a very self-educated writer here, as in writing the book was one long educational journey for me because I learned as I went along, and I had a lot of good teachers.
Well, self-education is sort of the folk way now, isn't it?
Well, for me, it was how I learned about bluegrass, in any case, yeah. I wanted to write the story of the brothers intrigued me, wanted to write about it. And actually was originally discouraged from writing about it, gently but nevertheless discouraged, because I was not an expert in bluegrass or old-time country. I tried to join forces with an expert, and he's actually one of the folks who had written an oral history of Ralph Stanley in the world of bluegrass. And he felt that he had kind of said what he had to say, and so I was on my own. And I kept plugging along and asking questions and gradually learning about the music.
See, this is what's interesting to me is I'm curious as to what the because, for example, on this program, I don't come to the music as any kind of expert at all, and so it sort of lends to extracting things that the experts may possibly not have explored because they think it's common knowledge or something, and I wonder if that comes out in the writing. Am I thinking that it does?
Could you just go a little further on that question?
The question is, for example, is this the kind of book that somebody would read if perhaps they didn't know too much about any of this stuff? I knew Clinch Mountain. I knew this. I knew
yes.
Ralph Stanley's. I knew Odeth.
The short answer is yes. I appreciate the question. Very good question. Yes, I wrote that specifically. I wrote it with the reader in mind. It's an academic press, University Press of Mississippi. God bless them. They published it, but at the same time, the audience I had in mind for the book were people like me who might be interested in the people in the music but didn't know all that much about the music, and people who were interested in Appalachia, basically, because I include a lot about communications, the development of the recording industry, little bit about the logging industry, stuff like that. And a lot of it is just because I thought it was interesting, so I included it.
Well, then it's good that I'm going to segue with this song right here. This is a song that, hey, maybe if you're deep, deep into the music, you know, it's not as important to you. But this is one that I used to hear that I used to really like, and I'm going to play a different version of it right now, and we will be right back. I'm Steve Carrigan. This is Local Folk, and my guest today is author David W. Johnson. We will be right back.
I was standing by my window Undertaker, please drive slow. For this lady that you're hauling, Lord, I hate to see her go.
Will the circle be unbroken by and by, Lord, by and by? There's a better home awaiting in the sky, Lord, in the sky.
Hey, welcome back to Local Folk. I'm your host, Steve Kerrigan. I need to give you an announcement. And the announcement is that the Stratum Memorial Library will present Make Sure It's Me, a discussion of traumatic brain injury experienced by American military service members on Tuesday, March 26th from 6:30 to 7:45 p.m., led by Artists Collaborative Theater of New England's Associate Director Leslie Pasternak, along with representatives of the medical and military fields. This discussion is part of Make Sure It's Me / New Hampshire, a community arts and education program project addressing traumatic brain injury. More information is available at lesliepasternak.com. I should say it's LesliePasternak, lesliepasternak.com. A discussion of traumatic brain injury experienced by American military service members. That's happening on March 26th, 6:30 to 7:45. Okay, very good. That is part of what's going on in the community calendar. And we're back. I'm back with my guest, David Johnson, and we're talking about his book, Lonesome Melodies, The Lives and Music of the Stanley Brothers. David was born in Connecticut, but was drawn to the music, and so much so that years and years later, even wrote a book about it right now about Carter and Ralph Stanley. And we were just talking a minute ago about being drawn to the music. And we were talking about the song that I played. I chose that song because that's one of the bluegrass songs that I'm familiar with. It's one of the ones where when that song would come on, people would say, hey, let's dance. Let's do this. You know, let's do that. Let's make it happen. And right before that, he was telling us that this book is written, you know, for people that maybe are not don't know everything about Ralph Stanley per se or anything like that, but they have an interest in the music and they have an interest in reading about what's behind the music.
Very much so. I think the way I look at it, I think honestly it's just a great American story. I mean, as in the Stanley brothers were born in the 20s, grew up during the Depression in the 30s, grew up hard in a household where their mom had trouble, you know, supporting them, and but they were working hard. Their dad was in the picture, but the family had split. So they finished high school in Virginia and went into the service. Carter served in World War II. Ralph served immediately after World War II. And then when they both got out of the service, they thought, you know, we don't want the coal mines. We don't want to do what our daddy did, which is he ran a sawmill business, as in cutting timber. We want to be musicians. And they played like 2 or 3 weeks with a band that was run by another person named Roy Sykes Jr. And Ralph gave Carter an ultimatum, like, hey, if we're going to do this music thing, it's just you and me. We're not doing it like for anybody else. And at a very young age, they were in their early 20s, they went off and formed a band. So to me, I mean, that it's so American. I mean, it happened with my brother forming a garage band and all that kind of thing. And they were those guys, except they were back there in the 1940s.
So did they, was it a rebellious thing to do back then for them to decide to be musicians? Were they a disappointment to their family?
No, I don't believe so. Actually, that's a very good question. Their father, Lee Stanley, was very, very supportive, and their mother had taught Ralph how to play the banjo, because she was one of 11 children, all of whom played the banjo. You know, that would be a great gathering at the press room on a on a Friday. Yes, but down in Appalachia, people weren't making banjo jokes. They were playing the banjo, and so Lucy Smith Stanley taught Ralph how to play the banjo when he was about 11. And Carter wanted an instrument, and so he got a mail order guitar. And then, of course, Ralph wanted a better banjo, and so it went. But they had their eyes on the prize, and they were performing as teenagers on radio, a lot of which I did not know, and until I started doing the research to find out that they really all their lives wanted to be musicians.
Well, when you say doing the research, do you mean what does it take to write a book? Where did you start? Did you talk to Ralph?
Yes, precisely. I talked to one person before Ralph, and that was a guy who was taking care of my computer when I was teaching down there. And he mentioned he had seen the Stanley Brothers perform in about 1949. And I thought, whoa, if this man who has a wonderful name, Max Powers, if Max Powers had seen the Stanley Brothers and remembered very well what it was like to see the Stanley Brothers, there would be other people around who would have memories. And it took a little bit to get into, but summer of 2003, I interviewed Ralph a couple times, once on the phone and once in person at his house.
Question, were they just so outstanding, you know, were they so much better than everybody else back then, or that this person remembered, or was it, had they become famous and he said, hey, I remember way back then?
Apparently, they were hot for a couple of years. They were just very, very, they're very, very hot. As I put it in the book, they hit a home run their first time at bat, because they got up. They started performing after they got out of the Army. Within 6 months, they had a radio show or less. That made them regional celebrities, but it was a powerful radio station, so it broadcast over 5 states.
So this is how I'm wondering is how they were able to accomplish this. How were they so good that they were able to get a radio show? I mean, were they just – what I'm saying is there must have been brothers. There must be the so-and-so brothers that went to the coal mine after they didn't do well as musicians or whatever. With these guys, did they practice all the time? What was it that made them stand out? Do you know?
Well, I think determination, for one thing. There are a lot of the people exactly of whom you speak, brothers and others.
For instance,
we don't hear a lot about Doc and Carl and the Virginia Boys, but those were two guys who played together who influenced the Stanley Brothers, and Doc was Doc Addington, the brother of Maybell Carter, who, and of course the Carter family made Will the Circle Be Unbroken,
right,
well known. So those guys never recorded. Nevertheless, the Stanleys saw them when they were like teenage boys and thought, wow, we want to be like those guys.
So you think it's the tenacity, or you think it's just it was a great mixture of all things?
I think a mixture. I think the voices. I think for one thing, the Stanley Brothers were blessed with exceptional musical voices, very different musical voices, and very distinctive, especially Ralph's. People have often put it, Ralph sounded, when he was like 20 years old, he sounded like an 80-year-old man, you know, when he was singing. He has an ancient voice. Carter has sort of, as a young man, had a sweet choir boy kind of voice. And yet, when those two voices blended together, they formed a third voice that was really essence of that Appalachian high lonesome sound. Sweet, but with a little bit of an edge.
So it was really just that they were that darn good. And
They were very, very good. They were very, very good. They auditioned at the radio station. There were 31 groups that auditioned at radio station WCYB. Two groups got the job. So clearly it was a competitive process. And their dad had kind of, you know, pushed them, but their dad couldn't sing for them. So they could sing, they could play.
Oh, the dad
and
encouraged
they had
them.
Personality. Very much, yeah.
Wow, that's very good. Okay, so they get a gig at the radio station. They must have felt like, hey, man, we're doing it now.
As Ralph put it, it was more about making their first record, but it also went with the radio station. You know, we thought we were at the top. When they were on the radio, when they made a record, they thought, wow, we have reached the top of the music business. We are stars. And in a local and regional way, they were. And that's why Max Powers remembered them. Because he still could remember, however many years later, he remembered Ralph's banjo crackling.
Yeah.
And just the energy that the show... They were like rock and rollers of their day, in a sense. In the country music world, they played faster, they sang tighter, and they were exciting.
Okay, so there was something that was exciting about them.
They were exciting,
Beyond the so their voices meshed really, really well.
Yes.
And created a third, bigger voice that was just magnificent.
Yes.
They were able to beat out the competition, 31 other bands, and get their own show. And they also had something else going for them, which was they went away from the norm just a little bit. They played a little bit faster, and they were excited, and they had this tenacity.
Yeah, they caused excitement or they created excitement. And Carter, as Ralph put it, I asked him about Carter, and he said, you know, Carter never met a stranger. It's just Carter was very gregarious, kind of a natural front man, whereas Ralph was, for years, the shy, retiring silent brother, and then has carried on for 40 years, doing his own thing.
I see. Did you see any of yourself in any of these guys?
Oh boy, that's a good question. I will say yes, not in terms of the excitement or the musical talent, but what I saw. I'm a brother.
Yeah,
I identified with the brothers, you know, what it's like. My brother and I never played that much together, the one who's the most musical, but I kind of like the idea of how that was. Now, this is kind of heavier. As with many families, my family's been touched by alcoholism, and I can say my uncle, who was my godfather and is deceased, died of complications related to alcoholism. So Carter's story, the alcoholism, had a personal interest and just in exploring what actually happened to Carter, and therefore what happened to my uncle. So I think I identified with the story, but in terms of seeing myself as a country performer or an exciting bluegrass performer, I already knew that I was kind of a slow open micer.
Yeah. Okay.
So, but also the tenacity. We all go through ups and downs, and I think I've had a couple of hard times in there, and I saw that they had, and they seemed very real and genuine to me.
Well, I guess what I'm thinking is that the relationship between the author and the people that you're writing about is kind of a special relationship, and I've never explored it on this program, which is why I'm asking these questions that are not things that I probably normally ask people, you know. Tell me about the relationship in general between who you're writing about and yourself. You don't. That last question was a little bit about living vicariously through them. Do you sense that, or are you making assumptions, or what is your role as author? I mean, in a lot of ways, an author is sort of like a lens, you know, that people are looking through in order to see what is happening.
Right.
In a way.
Yeah. Well,
is that how you think of yourself, or am I just, what is the relationship between you and them, and then you and the people that are listening? What is the art that's going on?
Well, thank you for crediting me with a certain amount of art. It's certainly, it's what I try to do, but let me answer your question. First of all, special kind of authorship here, as in it's a biography. And I think if you're writing a biography and you're immersing yourself in somebody's life, or in this case, lives, mm-hmm. You have to identify in some way with the subjects. And also, I think to some extent, you pretty much have to like them, or at least be able to live with them for a long time. And in my case, this was an unauthorized biography, as in the Stanley family. Ralph was, he had his autobiography in mind, which he published in 2009. The other side of the family, the Carter Stanley side, have been orphaned when young by their dad, so that was a very sensitive subject, and they saw that they thought there really should be a significant, if I may say, a significant book or movie about their father. And the idea of a, quote, professor writing a book about their father was not really what they had in mind. Eventually, a couple of them helped me quite a bit, and the others were fine, too. And also, I'm sensitive to the fact that I was writing about a person whom they loved, whom they had lost. So I had to proceed very carefully. Part of it, it just seemed to demand any skill set that I had or all the skills that I had. I was a former journalist. I was a teacher. I had been a researcher years ago in the British Museum for one summer, and I was kind of interested in the solving a mystery part of research, and I really am interested in people. And as a guy who had written about music for years and years and years, I'm actually now, I can claim about 50 years of writing about music, I thought, this is a really good story that needs to be told. And I was aware that the people who had experienced the Stanley Brothers firsthand were diminishing. And I was in a position to interview not only one of the brothers several times, but also interview people who knew them, interview a half-brother who is the child of their father, so I could find out more about the father. And a number of the people are not with us anymore. So I felt like I was more of a historian in that sense, a biographer and a historian, and that I was just in a unique position to do that.
Did you mean to be?
No. The story found me. I mean, really. I went to see I went to see a concert. I didn't even know precisely what the concert was about in Nashville, May 24th, 2000. And it was all the musicians who were on the soundtrack of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, before the movie had come out and before there was a soundtrack album. And this one guy who walked out on stage with no instruments and just one white spotlight on him and sang Oh Death, he caused the hairs on the back of my neck to stand up, and he got my full attention. And my original intent was to write a biography of Ralph Stanley. Then I found out that, oh, he has a brother, and according to one of the family members at the time, the brother drank himself to death. I mean, that was how it was phrased. And of course, I mentioned my own kind of affinity with the story of a person who might have what I consider a disease of alcoholism, and I thought, you know, I'd really like to explore that. But it came to me, and then one thing after another just sort of kept coming in my direction, and I am the lucky beneficiary of asking people a lot of questions about the Stanley Brothers.
Is there a moral in here, or is it just...
No. Okay. The last thing I wanted to do is to draw a moral.
This is not a fable.
No, these are very, very real people who led very difficult lives for much of their lives. At the same time, had their successes, and one of them went on to, you know, be a wealthy man, and Carter died a poor man.
Well,
by the way, I just want to mention the book is available at River Run Books and Sheaf Street Books, only because those folks are kind enough to carry it on consignment.
Well, this is what I was just going to start to ask about is people, you know, they want to get... By the way, the copy that's out right now is kind of like a prize. I mean, it's a real prize to get one. You can't just... I suppose you can order it, and you should.
You can, yes.
But it's pretty deluxe.
And you should, of course, yes.
Well, no, you should, but it's... pretty deluxe.
Well, my publisher's a university press. That's because really a university press was the only sort of publisher interested in publishing kind of a niche market book, and that's what this is considered because it's such a specialized book. Although I tried to write it in a non-specialized manner. And therefore it's designed and put together in the hardcover to be used in libraries, permanent collections, printed on archival paper. And I must mention the 14-page special photo section. That's a legal obligation to the publisher. I need to mention that at every opportunity.
Oh, all right. Well, that's fine. I mean, there's great pictures in here.
Thank you. Largely, many of them not really published, several not published before, and some actually Stanley family pictures that have been given to another person that were provided to me. So it helps to know what they look like, right? We always want to know what they look like.
You always want to know something. I mean, it certainly adds to it. Hey, it's got paternal grandparents here. It's, and the Stanley family together, you know, it has Roy Sykes. I mean, there's a lot of different pictures in here of different people, and it's nice to be able to visualize them. And it is on archival paper. It's a paperback. You know, it has, you know, nowadays people, can you get this on the Nook or whatever?
Yeah, it's available both on Nook and Kindle. Okay. It's widely available. The Usual Suspects, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, the not-so-usual suspects, countysales.com, which is a bluegrass and old-time country vendor.
So I was kind of flipping through the book here. What is this? This is chapter 17 here, starving out. What is that supposed to mean?
Starving out was a phrase that a guy named Fred Bartenstein, who's a writer about bluegrass, applied to a certain time. That meant, in two words, it meant Elvis Presley. It meant in 1956, Elvis and rock and roll pretty much wiped out bluegrass, and Fred called that the starving out period.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
And, no kidding.
And as Ralph said to me, he said, you know, a lot bigger acts than us, you know, went down during that time, as in they made it through.
They made it through the period where, because nowadays we really think of bluegrass as a niche market, although it has kind of created there's been a resurgence of bluegrass music, in my opinion. I mean, there are bluegrass nights.
Right. I think it is enjoying sort of a bit of a renaissance,
you know what?
Or whatever.
Here's, I'm going to put in my two cents about what I've learned about bluegrass,
okay.
And that is that I went down to Hazard, Kentucky,
down
to that radio station there. I went with a friend, and we actually met Ralph Stanley. We sat on stage with him at some kind of thing in Kentucky. It looked like a giant front porch, and it was a festival, bluegrass festival.
Yes.
And me and my friend Kevin Scanlon were sitting there, and next thing you know, Ralph Stanley sitting, you know,
no
next
kidding.
To, yeah, and he had some stories to tell, and they had conversation on stage. What we were doing on stage,
that's great.
Is another story, you know, altogether.
Well, right.
I think. But
you can tell us what we were doing on stage.
Well, quite frankly, he really wanted to meet Doc Watson, and we somehow finagled our way backstage, but backstage was also on stage. You know, being backstage was a ticket to being on stage.
I get it. Those festivals are amazing.
Yeah.
People would come to from London and elsewhere in British Isles and Europe to Ralph Stanley's festival in near Coburn, Virginia, because they'd be able to just walk right up to anyone. I mean, I got caught in the rain at one of Ralph's festivals and ended up in a tent, under a small tent with Gillian Welch, and we had a wonderful conversation about her singing. They're just very down to earth and intimate. Yeah,
incredibly intimate. I mean, this stage was set up to look like a giant front porch, and all of the performers were welcome to sit on the front porch. My friend had gotten backstage as a performer, I guess.
Yeah.
At least in, he looked like a performer.
Well, it's a lot of how you carry yourself, right?
Yeah. So next thing you know, him and I are sitting on stage, and Ralph Stanley sitting next to us while Doc Watson's playing.
I would say it does not get any better than that. I did have the pleasure of seeing Doc a couple of times, and I thought,
it was totally amazing.
This is as good as it gets.
The whole thing was amazing, you know. And anyways, he was there, and we saw Ralph Stanton. We saw his big bus that he tours around, and he was very proud of that and very thankful, you know.
Oh yes. Yeah. All his life, Carter wanted to have a bus. Carter's a bigger guy. Was a bigger guy than Ralph, and was not that comfortable in the cars they drove around. He wanted to have a bus because he would have been more comfortable. Never got the bus. But then Ralph got the bus.
Ralph got a totally deluxe bus. I mean, it was a RV bus style, Ralph Stanley,
yep.
You know, the airbrushed on the side and everything else.
I have seen it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
You
probably spent a lot of time in that bus.
No. It's just a landmark. I used to teach at University of Virginia's College at Wise, and every day on my way to work, I could tell whether Ralph was at home or on the road, depending on whether the bus was in its parking place along Route 58 in Virginia.
See, there you go. And see, there's that. And then also, and right on the front of the book, they're wearing suits, you know. And,
yeah, always dressed, you know, seriously.
Always dressed up, you might say.
Yes, yes.
They wore their best suits and everything else. And that was something that I always thought, you know, as I was at that time, I wanted to go for rock star, right? And
right.
What are you doing? You know, but they took it very seriously to dress nicely.
Well, this, if I may, this raises a point here, which is Bill Monroe really started that. Well, Carter family did too, which is dressing absolutely in their Sunday best. And one of the things in this biography I wanted to do was write about a couple of old-time country musicians from Big Spraddle Creek as seriously and with as much respect as one would write about any artist or person who's led a, you know, sort of a history-worthy life. And so I start with their ancestry, and I go on with that. But that's part of the deal, to take them as seriously as they actually felt that they deserved to be taken.
Well, you know, and I wonder what kind of a struggle this, or an issue this was for them. I always think that they dressed up to be taken seriously.
Yes.
And yet, yeah, I never would have thought to dress up to be taken seriously. You know, and you're talking about their ancestry and everything else, but the fact is, they were very important.
I think they are very important American musicians. And the Smithsonian Institution, I believe, picked one of their songs, "Rank Stranger," to be named like a significant American recording. But I think their realness and their authenticity, to overused word, but nevertheless, a lot of the people I ran into looked at the Stanley Brothers as the sort of the touchstones of authenticity for old-time country and bluegrass, and therefore to be taken seriously.
Hey, I'm going to give you the last word. Thanks for talking to me. Thank you very much for coming on Local Folk. I love the look and feel of this book. I can't wait to dig into it, if I may. The music as well. I'm glad that we were able to share these experiences. And also, you know, your experience with how you are relating to the music with the skills that you have. You're an author.
Well, I guess with a book out, I am an author, but I am an author in service of a subject here. So it worked out.
Well, okay. Very good. Well, David, thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve.
We're going to get going here on Local Folk, and we're going to see you next week. But until then, have a wonderful week, and we'll see you then. Bye-bye.
My latest son is taking phase. My race is nearly run. My strongest trials now are past. My triumph has begun.
Angel band, come and parade. to my